Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, child advocate Dr. Katie McConnell, and research director Andy Canales. What do we have on tap today, Katie and Andy?
Oh, how are you?
I am great. It's good to be back here with you, the Candy Show.
That's right.
We actually have a lot of guests calling in today, so it may not be as much candy and more talking to other people outside.
More information.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, while we can put on a heck of a show, we'll be getting, hopefully, having some callers call in to talk to us a little bit. We've also got a great lineup today. Here in the studio with us, we, of course, have Dr. Claire Bikini here with two of her... I always forget the proper term.
Well, they're pediatric residents, but they're pediatricians.
Wonderful pediatricians. Yeah. We're happy to have you guys here with us, too. And we'll have a chance to talk about a very important topic this time of year around flu shots. And also, as we were kind of discussing beforehand, we know the federal government is really working hard right now. Hopefully working hard right now.
To reauthorize CHIP.
Yes. That's a very important insurance measure for many of our kids here in the state of Texas, well, throughout the country. So
that's exactly right.
We'll be talking a little bit about that. We also have calling in Children at Risk staff member Charanya Ravi Kumar, and she will be talking to us about the significance of the number 3 million.
Exciting.
Any predictions on what that number might be, Andy?
Perhaps about the number of children who, something unique about them.
Wow,
that would be my wild
really,
guess, but I'm a research director, so.
3 million children have something unique about them. I wonder if it has something to do with the reauthorization of CHIP,
perhaps.
I don't know. We'll see. What else do we have today?
Well, after Data Head, we're going to be talking to Christina Trantafilis, who is the Chief Officer of Public Policy and Strategic Initiatives at Collaborative for Children, a phenomenal nonprofit here in Houston that's been doing a lot of work around Hurricane Harvey relief.
That's right. And I think Christina's calling in from the road, where also some of our colleagues from Children at Risk have been today, calling in after a legislative hearing today about Harvey recovery efforts. So we'll get a chance to talk to your normal host and our fearless leader, Dr. Bob Sanborn, to tell us a little bit how that event went today and see if we have any updates as we continue to move forward after Harvey.
Absolutely. And today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in and share your opinion in our thumbs up, thumbs down segment. Should schools still have libraries? Children at Risk policy analyst Gretchen Himza will give us a surprising report on the current state of libraries in Houston schools.
So we had a little preliminary conversation about this, Andy, and I have to say it was one of those times where I felt like the old lady where I was, you know, stay off my lawn is what I felt like. Because the thought of a school without a library really kind of chokes me up. Like, it is really hard for me to imagine that. And perhaps it's based on my experiences growing up that the library was like the hub of learning. But I have chills talking about it. Anyways, we'll get to that point.
It'll be a very interesting
discussion. Because I know we don't necessarily see eye to eye on this.
That's right.
Andy, and all your newfangled technology. Anyways, as we mentioned, we will close the show today with Dr. Claire Bikini and her residents, Sarah Smith and Maya Brasher. And they're going to be sharing what we need to know about cold and flu season. It's that time of year, as well as the reauthorization of CHIP.
Sounds like a great show.
I think it's going to be a fantastic hour. Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio, a discussion on our children, public policy, politics, and our future, and how we do as a nation when it comes to taking care of all of our kids.
Every week, we aim to fill the same 58 minutes with lively discussion on the status of children in America from experts on the quality of life for America's children.
I'm Katie.
I am Andy.
And we are ready for a great show today, right, Andy?
That's right.
I feel like it's so appropriate today. We're kicking off with the candy show, the month of December.
That's right.
As we know that there's a lot of sweet, tasty goodness.
Candy with a K.
Candy with a K, of course, a combination of Andy and Katie. But we were already starting to have the discussion in the office around the holidays and, you know, please don't bring your leftovers to the office and leave them on the table anymore. Enough is enough already. So we're already at that point. So here we are. First things first, to lead us off, we have... Ha! We know what that music means. On the line, we have Char calling in from the Children at Risk staff. Char, are you there? Hey, how are you this afternoon?
No leftover candy in the office. Oh my gosh, best idea.
Enough, right? We've already reached that point in the holiday season.
It's sad not to see the candy there, so it's hard.
Oh, I don't know. It's not hard for me to not see it. It's so much, and it starts so early and goes on for so long anyway.
Yeah.
Perhaps 3 million calories, the amount of extra calories we take in during the holiday season. From a medical standpoint, pediatricians, does that sound about right?
Oh, man. It sounds like a lot.
Yeah, 3 million. Sounds like we may be overdoing it. Char, what can you tell us about the number 3 million?
Well, the number 3 million, not quite candy or calories related, but it is food related. And 3 million is Texas students who are actually eligible for free or reduced price school meals here in Texas.
Wow, that's a lot of students. 3 million students who are eligible for free or reduced price meals at their schools.
That's right. And so in Texas, as we know, 1 in 4 children are food insecure, so about 26% of our children. And we have the opportunity via schools for these children to receive food either via a school breakfast program or a lunch program or after-school program or even a summer meal program. But what's interesting is not all of these 3 million children actually take advantage of these free or reduced school meal programs.
Now, Char, why, help us understand, you have the opportunity to access food. Why wouldn't our kids be accessing those free or reduced meals within our school setting?
Right, and there's a lot of different reasons. Also, these number of children are eligible. Not all school districts are actually taking advantage of the program and applying for the funds to actually implement the program in their schools. So that's one big interesting reason. And then there are, of course, schools where these meals are being offered, but the children are then not taking advantage of these meals either. You know, they're uncomfortable taking these meals, or they don't get to school in time to take advantage of these meals, or they've been picked up too early. There's all kinds of other reasons as well. So, but you can broadly divide them into two categories. So either the schools themselves are not aware and not even offering these programs, despite there being some funding available, or despite them offering these programs, not all students are taking advantage of these programs.
That's really difficult to hear, and I'm going to punt it here to our in-house pediatricians and just Reader's Digest version. Remind us all, we know why it's important. We're aware of our, I can even testify to what happened in our office today when a couple of us got a little hungry. But why is it so important that our kids are having those breakfast in particular, but breakfast and lunch while they're in school? Would either of you care to comment?
Sure. I think it's so important for these children to have access to not just breakfast, but healthy options as well. It helps improve their concentration. It helps them improve on test scores and with their grades. And I think it's so important for these children to be set up for success in that way.
And not only that, in terms of just talking about the obesity epidemic and their weight, it's really important for children to have a nutritious breakfast to get their metabolism going earlier on in the morning. So that's another component that I think that especially breakfast at school can offer these kids, in addition to nutrition that would help them with concentration.
And I think that there was a point that you mentioned here about nutritious and healthy, right?
Right.
I saw a report that was just released by Harvard last week that said that today's children, over 50% of them are on track to being obese by the time they're adults.
Wow.
And I know part of the challenge in creating healthy and nutritious meals is that sometimes they might not be appealing to kids in schools.
That's true. I'm just sitting here thinking back to my days on cafeteria duty in the morning and some of the things that served. I, no exaggeration, remember walking in one day and going, oh, we're having funnel cakes for breakfast this morning. And it was actually funnel cakes. However, I will tell you, the nutrition director was quick to identify that those said funnel cakes were made from wheat and they were baked and not fried and therefore met the minimal nutritional value requirements to be reimbursed by, I guess, the U.S. Department of Agriculture or whoever is supplementing the food program. So that was, even under the healthy umbrella, there's still ways, I think, that we're pushing the limits a little bit more maybe than we should.
Right. Absolutely. So one of the things children at risk, our food in schools team does is to sort of consult with these schools, share best practices, connect them with other schools who are actually implementing the program and able to find the right funds to not just offer these meals, but offer the right kinds of meals. So we do need to sort of help these school districts. And so our food in schools team is trying to do that, which is important.
That's great. Well, our public schools, of course, again, I'm very biased, but our schools are lucky to have people like Children at Risk and many different organizations helping to fight for healthy nutritional food in our schools for our kids, for them to have the access and, you know, just be able, the understanding why it's so important to have these meals. Char, thank you so much for calling in this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Char.
You guys.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. 3 million. That's just, it's an astounding number. Next on the agenda for today, we have on the line Christina Triantafillis. Christina, are you with us?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Oh, that's nice intro music for you. Happy to talk to you. So how did it go in Austin today?
Fantastic. It was a wonderful turnout. Thank you all for organizing such a great event, a great group of legislative staff, and a wonderful group of panelists, lots of diverse experts in all the areas that Harvey impacted. So I think it was overall a good morning.
Great. So when you loaded up, I assume, this morning and headed to Austin, what's your message, Christina? What do we need to continue to drive home to our elected officials from not only the local Houston delegation, but throughout the state?
Well, one of the things that we were all, I think, sharing was that this is going to be a long process. I think a lot of people, the news footage is done, the sort of hero honeymoon period is over, but I think a lot of the panelists were and the presenters were just emphasizing what a long road to recovery this is going to be for many families and for lots of institutions in our community. I think the other thing that was emphasized was just the importance of data in driving decisions and the allocation of resources in a targeted way to those that were most severely impacted, and the challenges of doing that, but also the opportunities that exist and with a lot of information in this day and age. And then I think just the policy opportunities, different opportunities for the state to think about how to build a resilient and better equipped community and response in the future. This is unfortunately becoming common in our Houston area, whether we like it or not. These large rain events and floods have been happening way too often in the last few years. So we have to deal with this new reality and think about the next one while we're addressing this recovery.
That's right. I love those 3 points, those kind of big ideas that you identified there. It sounds like we've got a plan. I feel like we should just do it, right? If only it were that simple.
Yes, easier said than done, I guess.
Right. What specifically, how do these, again, around these kind of 3 points, around the long-term recovery and the data-driven recommendations and the policy opportunities, how does this specifically impact the collaborative for children? For for our listeners that may not be familiar with your organization, can you kind of tell us what y'all do and the opportunities you have here?
Sure. So Collaborative for Children is a nonprofit serving the greater Houston area. We work in 13 counties in the Gulf Coast, and our primary mission and what we go to work for every day is to improve the quality of early learning. That means we work with child care providers, teachers, directors, and child care professionals to improve the quality of the learning environment that very young children have before they enter kindergarten. We work with parents and caregivers to make sure they're equipping their children with the right experiences before kindergarten and that they have the information they need to make informed choices about child care. And then we work with policymakers and decision makers to improve our state systems. And so in the wake of Harvey, we remembered what we think is obvious, but what a lot of people don't, which is that child care is really a multi-generational workforce and education issue. And that means that parents need access to child care in order to go to work. So especially in the wake of a disaster, in order to bounce back and get to work, you need your child care provider to be open and operating. And then children, the other part of that multi-generational component is that children need quality childcare because that sets them on a path to high quality education and educational achievement and then preparing for a workforce. So with that in mind, we always try and collect data right away on what is going on with our childcare providers. And we have a strong relationship with and can quickly survey our providers in the 13 county region. And we found almost immediately that about 30% of our providers were impacted in some way, shape, or form, whether that was very little damage or ranging from that level of damage to completely destroyed. And so
that wow, was- a 30%, almost a third of your providers. Can you give us what does that translate to in numbers as far as kids impacted? Do you know that number? That seems like a huge amount.
That's a lot.
Yes, sure. We estimate that about 23,000 children are enrolled in these programs, and that 7,300 of them are children who participate in the child care subsidy program, which means they're receiving government funding because their parents are low income and are working or going to school and rely on child care in order to do those things. So lots of children and lots of children on that subsidy system.
And Christina, what is something that the state legislature can do or elected officials to help address this situation, especially for the 7,300 children who are most vulnerable, right, in society?
Mm-hmm. Well, we are we're working to think about that right now. We are, because of the generous support of organizations like Save the Children and the Greater Houston Community Foundation's Hurricane Relief Fund, we're able to respond in what I call kind of that short-term recovery way, where we're helping these providers bounce back, improve and restore their learning environments. But I think where our elected officials and where the state can help play a role is thinking about how we build resiliency for the future. So one of the things that we've learned after the storm is that a large proportion of providers don't carry flood insurance.
Right.
These are small businesses that we know at least 30% are not carrying flood insurance, and we're trying to understand the reasons why. Is that out of reach financially? Are they being turned away for some reason? That maybe there are policy levers that we could pull, and with the help of some clever incentives, make sure that since this is becoming a common event and a lot of providers who were flooded in previous floods were again impacted this time, how do we incentivize their accessing flood insurance so that the ability to recover and not rely solely on philanthropic sources of funding is there? That's one idea that we're working on.
That's really interesting. And I'm just sitting here kind of processing. I would not, based on my background and my experience, that is not the route. I mean, I think I'm still thinking more short term, right? Like we need to replenish books, we need to replenish supplies, make sure that kids, if they are able to go into their centers at this point in time, that they have access to resources. But I think that long term planning.
True, and that's what we're calling kind of phase one, and we're working diligently to try and deliver on those specific outcomes. And you know, we're finding out now if we have enough resources for that piece. So as we speak, we're administering vouchers for child care providers to be able to go onto a portal and choose from recommended child development friendly materials that they can use to replenish the high quality learning environment, and also pairing that with online training on what effective learning environments are like, so that when they go and have a chance to sort of build anew, if there was any silver lining to this, they have a chance to sort of remake some of their spaces with some of the support. They're doing it in a way that optimizes learning for these young children.
And that's fantastic. We know that it's not just about having the building or the structure. It's the quality of the work that's being done inside. Christina, thank you so much for calling in today, for your participation in the Heart for You Recovery Collaboration, and just for the work that Collaborative for Children does. We're lucky to have you here in our city.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you for all you do as well. And it was a pleasure talking.
Great. Thank you. All right. Man, there's a long way to go before we get back to...
Well, and the challenging thing is that how do you keep this need and challenge at the forefront of people's minds?
That's
and
right.
attention, right? Because I think most people you would pull and ask on the street might not be aware of
That's
the
right.
extent of this challenge.
Well, guess who our next caller is? I bet they have some ideas how we want to keep this on the forefront of our minds. How about that? Dr. Sanborn, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. How you guys doing?
We are great. How are you?
Very good. I'm listening to my theme song. I guess you guys picked out a little Beatles song.
It's good. We did. We have a Beatles-themed show today. Christina also had the Beatles intro music.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm good. So I'm in Austin, right? I'm in Austin today, and we have this big thing at the state legislature. And Christina Trentafillis, who was on your show, on the program just a second ago, was there. But we had representatives from all the people who are working together, or a lot of the people that are working together on the Hurricane Harvey Children's Collaborative, right? And this whole idea is we're focusing on recovery of children, but we really need to get the state legislature involved. And, you know, and I felt like, I don't want this to be something that just happened and people were alarmed and now we're going to get on with things. And sometimes at the state level, you sort of get that feeling when indeed in Houston, we know whole neighborhoods that are still in recovery. And we know that certainly, you know, 600,000 children that have been affected by the storm and their lives are not complete as of yet. So a lot of work to do. And that's what we've been doing in Austin today.
So how what was the nature of the conversation? You know, Andy just brought up a great point. How do we continue to bang the drum? How do we keep that? We see it every day when we pass by piles of trash. What was the messaging today to be sure that everybody knows that it's not done and this is going to be a long-term effort?
Yeah, I mean, we revisited the storm a little bit, but the idea was then to go on what we've to go on and talk about what we've been doing in the area of housing, what we've been doing in the area of food and food insecurity in our schools, in childcare, health care, and then also mental health, and then talking a little bit about our most vulnerable children. I think a lot of people don't understand the numbers of runaways have gone up, the number of kids that are homeless have gone up. The storm has really exacerbated this whole, everything that can go wrong in a family. It's sort of made it worse. And so we're seeing large numbers of kids. And I still go back, Katie and Andy, to this idea that the trauma perpetuated by this storm is significant. And we don't have the resources in town, nor are we currently doing enough training around mental health and trauma and really trying to get these kids back on their feet. And so there's still a lot of work to do, but we talked about all those different areas. Great speakers today. And we had, you know, 50 legislative offices show up, and it was really nice. Representatives Davis and Senator Huffman sponsored it, and I think there's still a lot of education to be done, and so we brought the experts. We just can't let it drop, right? The idea
That's
is
right.
with so many children going through this, we just can't let it drop.
Well, and it's good to hear that we have support of some of our local delegation there, right? To hear Representative Davis, to hear Senator Huffman are willing to host an event like this so these different organizations can come together and really help us spread the word that we still need help.
Right.
And this is going to be a long, long-term recovery process.
And I imagine part of the challenge is that, as Dr. Sanborn was saying, we're not going to see some of the effects of the storm for a while.
That's right.
Right? So we're not going to see that data really emerge probably until next year. And in the meanwhile, we have a lot of children and people that are suffering, not just in Harris County, but in the 57 other counties
That's
that
right.
were declared disaster zone by the governor.
And Andy, you and I have talked about this a lot, though, and I mentioned this a little bit today, but that a lot of these numbers that we talk about don't include families who, for one reason or another, are not coming forward, right? They're
right.
not, they don't want any attention. You know, they may have an undocumented member in their family. They don't want this attention. And so we have whole families that aren't asking for help. And these are also part of our most vulnerable children. You know, they may be American kids, but if a mom or a dad or an uncle is undocumented, believe me, they're not asking for help.
Right. So now it's more important than ever to see what is happening at the congressional level, especially with the second or the additional round of Harvey funding. I know that that hasn't
right.
been really on the headlines given other things happening around the world in
other
our country.
Things, that's right.
Lots of things going on the wrong. Hey, I wanted to talk about another thing, guys, and I don't know if you've mentioned it, but, you know, the shortlist for Time Person of the Year came out today. Did you guys happen to see that?
I did, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to get your ideas on who you guys think should be the Time Person of the Year, because there are a lot of good names there, but I'm really fascinated by the idea of the hashtag MeToo movement.
Right.
It seems to me that that should be the clear winner this year of sort of the idea of the year.
Right.
With all this sexual harassment being rampant, and we know it's always been there, but I think it's really sort of come out a lot, right?
Yeah.
And I think people are speaking out about this. And I love the idea that it's so upfront, and I would like to propose that should be something that we should be saying, hey, this hashtag MeToo movement, that needs to be the idea of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that so in the list, there are two groups, and then the rest are individuals. One group is the hashtag MeToo movement. The other group is the Dreamers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other individuals, Colin Kaepernick, President Trump.
Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos, that's right, and a few others. Now, you know, someone that a group that I didn't see, and I may be mistaken, but I don't think I saw, is the people that stepped up during these hurricanes, right? Especially here in Houston,
yeah.
and saved others and put their lives at risk. I mean, the response this year was just incredible, and I don't think I saw that group on the list.
No, I would say something like the Cajun Navy,
right?
Would definitely. Could earn its place on a list like this. It had a huge impact.
I love the idea that the whole first responders, right? Having all the first responders. And we saw, you know, heroes in Houston. We saw heroes after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. And we're still seeing a lot of the work of those heroes. And some of those people are right on our staff, you know, working on this Hurricane Harvey Children's Collaborative. And there's still a lot of work to be done. So, yeah, Katie, do you have a favorite on that short list for Time Person of the Year?
Well, I'm going to go with my nomination for the Cajun Navy. Thank you very much. that's who I would. That's
yeah,
who, I haven't seen the comprehensive list yet.
I tell you, it's not on the short list.
So, yeah, unfortunately. I will do my research, though, and read up on the list, and maybe I can call in next week and offer my support.
I love how Dr. Sanborn just took over the show and changed the topic and co-moderated
right.
from Austin.
From Austin, right? Live from the Capitol, the Bob Sanborn Show.
Any other topics you want to discuss,
Dr. Sanborn? Yeah, anything we need to cover?
No, listen. I'm good. I'm off to Dallas tomorrow, but thank you guys very much. Mandy and I are so appreciative of you top-notch professionals. I mean, you make us look bad, right? I mean, because you guys are so good on the air.
Right. We're so smooth and easy on the air. You're exactly right. Thank you. Well, hey, safe travels. Thanks to you and Mandy and the team for hosting the event today in Austin. It sounds like it went really well. We'll look forward to hearing more about it when you get back and hopefully you're seeing the outcome from this.
Hey, what's thumbs up, thumbs down today, by the way?
Ooh, it's a good one. It's about libraries and public schools.
Oh,
should
sounds really good.
Have regular traditional libraries.
Oh, excellent.
Or is technology the way of the future?
I'm thumbs up to libraries, that's for sure. Oh. All right, guys. Hey, take care, and hey, hug your kids, and I'll see you guys next time.
Sounds good. Thanks, Dr. Bob. Safe travels.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. I'm going to have to read up on my time list. I just didn't
see that one coming.
I didn't spend the time on the interwebs today like I should have to make sure I was fully prepared for the random Dr. Bob update. But with that, we're going to throw it out to Don real quick for a quick weather and traffic update, and we'll come back with thumbs up, thumbs down.
All right, folks, traffic and weather update. Some of the traffic has changed, so let's talk about some stalls. South Sam Houston Tollway, eastbound at Hiram Clark, we have a stall eating up the right shoulder. On Northwest Freeway, Gulf Freeway, southbound at Broadway Street Park Place, we have a stall eating up the center lane. Also on 45 northbound at 610 North Loop, we have a heavy truck stall, right shoulder. Hardy Toll Road, northbound at Cross Timbers, we have a stall eating up the what? You already know, right shoulder. I don't know what's going on with these right shoulders. Today you're feeling a good 78 degrees, but later tonight we have 50% chance of showers and a low of 68 degrees. And then tomorrow we have more thunderstorms coming in and a high of 71 degrees all day. Now back to you guys in the studio.
Thanks, Don. We're looking forward to that weather change coming up tomorrow. Slightly less heat and less humidity. A lot less heat, actually.
Yeah.
So, all right. Next up, Andy?
Well, it is now time for our social conscious scale, where we take timely and newsworthy items and comment on them via our SCS with thumbs up or thumbs down. We know what that music means.
Yeah, we do.
Social conscious scale. Feel free to call in to weigh in on the issue by dialing 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. But remember, absolutely no fence sitting.
No fence sitting at all.
And if you can't call in, you can vote on our Growing Up in America Facebook page. Facebook.com/Growing Up in America Radio! And today's topic is, should schools still have libraries?
And I apologize. I just jumped on my bandwagon as soon as the show started because this is something I feel so passionate about. But I'm going to wait. Before we let anyone else talk about their feelings, mm-hmm. we have on the line, as you mentioned, Gretchen Hemsel, who's a policy analyst at Children Risk, and she's going to give us some facts, Andy, facts about libraries in Houston schools. So before we like get all our feelers involved,
we're going to get some facts.
We're going to get some facts, and hopefully we can come to some appropriate conclusions that I agree with. Gretchen, are you on the line?
I am. Hi, everybody.
Hi, are you ready? I'm not going to say to ruin our afternoon because I'm already putting my perspective off on you. You have some great information, though. I think it's probably going to be startling for a lot of people. Can you lay some of these facts on us?
Well, one of the biggest fact that I think is significant is that however you feel about libraries or no libraries, there is definitely a decrease in the number of certified librarians in HISD schools. So we might have a full library in one situation, but there are no librarians on staff, and so then the books aren't being checked out to the students. So, for example, there are over 30,000 employees in HISD, and only 70 of them are librarians. That's right.
Gretchen, even that just sent a chill down my spine.
283 schools in Houston ISD.
That's right.
And 70.
That's right.
Librarians in the whole dish. Okay, good fact. That's a fact. Good.
Is that because children are leveraging technology and reading on their tablets and computers and don't need to go to the library anymore?
That's part of it. And part of it, there's been a transition to the classroom library. And so then teachers will have books just in the classroom and they don't go to a actual new room to get checkout books. There's no library time. It's not part of ancillary. And you don't go before or after school, but rather just choose books from the classroom.
And that's good. I can see that the kind of the, I think you used the word decentralization of the libraries. That's good. But there is something to be said for having immediate access to multiple resources, to multiple books. If you're, I'm just going to bring up my own childhood experience. If you're, for example, writing a research paper on foxes, Andy, mm-hmm. it would be important to be able to go to the fox section in the library, whereas a classroom teacher may just have one book about foxes for you to gather information on.
Or I can just go online and search foxes and cows and dogs and cats and any other topic.
You absolutely can.
Andy brings up a good point, because a lot of research now, even in the elementary school level, is going online. But without a librarian who is trained in research techniques, students aren't learning how to decide what is a good website, what is a questionable website, what is an advertisement. Librarians really help students learn how to do research and how to decipher what's fake news.
No, and we need that more than ever right
now,
right?
I was going to say, I think you hit the nail on the head with the fake news, because I think we probably all can attest to the number of adults that we even know that have a hard time differentiating between spin, fake news, facts based, or, you know, a story based on facts but not actually factual. So I think that without kids having explicit training in that, and I know there are master's degrees in library science, and there are several school districts around the city that require librarians to have that master's degree. So they do have a refined skill set that they can really implement to help students grow.
That's right. It's not just like the librarians of old, where it's someone stamping books with an ink pad, but librarians now are trained in digital information, researching citations, as well as proper writing techniques.
Now, how do children who are growing up with smartphones, right, and iPads, like, how do we make that transition? Because I think it's clear that there's a lot of change that is happening in how people consume, and the next generation is consuming and accessing information. Which is why I would argue that perhaps we don't need libraries anymore, but we do need that training and the technology.
Oh, I think you're right, but I'm going to quickly add the but. Dr. Bikini, did you have something to say, to add to that? You look like you were going for the microphone before I...
Oh, no, I mean, I do have an opinion, but I'll wait till we get to that point.
While we're still exploring the facts.
Yeah, I'll let you explore the facts first.
Well, I was part of what I was going to say, too. I think about kids, many kids who are tactile learners, many of our kids, and in particular, studies have shown many of our at-risk kids tend to be more tactile learners. And so how the difference in an iPad or some sort of tablet reading versus being able to track print on a page, I feel like, and hold a book and maneuver it, I feel like that could help kids in how they're able to consume information, and not just consume it, but actually comprehend it and then be able to use the information in a meaningful way. That's part of my argument. Mm-hmm. One of my many points, why we still need libraries. So with that, let's hear it. Andy, where are you? Where are you falling on this one? Thumbs up or thumbs down, school libraries?
As much as I love libraries, and that one of my first jobs in high school was actually working in the library, I'm going to say thumbs down. I think we need to evolve, change, and adapt. You know, there's a commercial, brand new commercial Apple just released this weekend. Little girl playing with an iPad Pro and a attachable keyboard. And her neighbor asks her, what are you doing on the computer? And she turns around and says, what's a computer?
Oh,
and
wow.
I think that, you know, things are changing and children are accessing information in different ways. And we have to completely reimagine, rethink that aspect of their education.
That's very interesting. That's very progressive of you, Andy. Like I said, I see myself. We do have a caller on the line. Johnny is on the line with feelings about our school libraries. Johnny, are you there?
Yeah, and I sure have feelings about this stuff.
Well, for my sake, Johnny, I hope you're siding with me. But let's hear what you have to say about your thoughts on the libraries.
When a child says, what's a computer, that's flag number one. Flag number two is computer screens are ephemeral. Books provide a stability that make it very hard or near impossible for right-wing extremist Republicans to rewrite. Of course, books can be burned, but that doesn't change the fact that young children need to be made aware of how ephemeral of a quality information is on a screen, and they need to be able to understand how to use a conventional library system. Libraries can evolve, but they don't have to be destroyed, especially in the USA, USA, USA.
Thank you, Johnny. And you know what? I do think you brought, I love one of the words you mentioned there, they have to evolve. Because I can think, even in my educational experience, going from being an undergraduate trying to write a research paper, and at that point in time, back when I was an undergrad with the dinosaurs, we still had to use an actual card catalog to sift through to find something, versus having just finished my doctorate a year ago, it was a much different experience in writing papers and doing research at that point in time. So I can see where there are benefits to using the word that Johnny used, where libraries have evolved, but they shouldn't be annihilated entirely. Dr. Bikini, let's hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I bet everybody here has their own opinions, but I haven't actually looked at any data that says whether or not having a library results in improved outcomes in schools. But from the American Academy of Pediatrics, books are really important for young kids. It's important for their development. We know that parents reading to kids with books has a much greater impact, and that's why we try to decrease screen time for young kids. And so I'm very pro thumbs up for libraries so that kids can check out books, take them home. And I'm sure I'm biased because I loved that as an elementary school student, checking out books, taking them home, reading them with my parents. And that was really exciting to me. And older kids, you're exactly right. They need to learn how to research things correctly. And I think that having a librarian or somebody with that skill set to teach the students is really important. So I'm thumbs up, with the caveat that I haven't actually seen specific data to say that libraries are important for schools.
Opinions are okay, Dr. Bikini, and I absolutely support that opinion of yours. Dr. Sarah, what do you think?
Yes, I completely agree. I'm definitely thumbs up for libraries. I come at it thinking about it as another form of media, and the American Academy of Pediatrics definitely warns pediatricians to try to teach our parents to limit social media. And so I think that doing everything on tablets can potentially be hazardous. And so I think just the physicalness of a book instead of using a tablet at all times is definitely beneficial for kids.
And you brought up something, as I sit up straighter in my chair in the booth here, you brought up the physicalness of the books, but also the physicalness of screen times. When we were discussing it, we talked about the difference in your posture when reading a book versus looking at a tablet. And we were all like, oh, wait, it's different. It doesn't feel the same. So, we don't want everybody to have the hunched over backs and necks that we're all bound to have anyway, because we're always looking at our phones. But, if we can start our
too
kids,
right?
Too late. But if we can start some of those, just another argument to help kids experience something different in the classroom. In particular, that's a very meaningful and logical place for it. Dr. Maya, do you have opinions on this one?
I certainly do. I am thumbs up for libraries as well. Partly because of my experience as a kid, I loved libraries. And as a pediatrician, I think screen time is a huge issue. And just in addition to just reading books on iPads, kids now have all their homework on iPads or laptops. Schools are giving them laptops. In addition to all this, the issues that come up with using social media, they're already on their screens for fun, for leisure. They're also on their screens for homework. And now they're on their screens again for reading books. And that to me is just, you're crossing that threshold. You're on the border of it already. And so you're crossing it even further.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective either. Just diversifying experiences. If everything else is on the computer, let's allow the opportunity to be old-fashioned, if you will. Like I said, this kind of makes me feel like the old lady. Stay off my lawn.
Well, it looks like your opinion is quite popular, because I'm
is.
A little outmatched this afternoon.
You absolutely are. Sorry, Andy Canales. But it sounds like on this one, your traditional library is going to win out. So, Johnny, thank you for calling in, for sharing your opinion, as well as for everyone else here. If we had our way, we'd have more than just 70 librarians in HISD. 70. That's startling. Anyway,
I don't get an answer.
Oh, Don, I do apologize.
It's okay.
Now, let me say, if you agree with us, the majority of us, you're absolutely allowed to have an opinion. If not, we're going to go ahead right into the next topic.
Okay, my bad.
Okay. No, good talk. No, let's hear your opinion.
No, my opinion is not only libraries themselves need to always be around, but physical media is one of those things that people don't understand that at any time we can lose all of this digital things that we have. And to take advantage of, oh, we don't need books anymore, we don't need libraries anymore, let's go all digital. Once that goes down, then what do we have? It becomes the Twilight Zone episode where the guy's glasses break and he can't read anymore.
That's absolutely right. And you know what? I feel so good now because you absolutely just helped me rationalize my book hoard that I have in my home. So thank you much. I feel so much better. No, but that's a really good point. Think about like during something like Hurricane Harvey. I know there were many kids and families that struggled because iPads ran out of juice pretty quickly. Internet was down. Power was out. And there were many folks that were struggling because that's what their kids were accustomed to for long periods of time, unfortunately. So thank you. Excellent point, Don. With that, I'm actually going to kick it back to you for a quick weather and traffic update before we get to dig into cold and flu season with our resident pediatricians.
All right, folks, back with traffic and weather. You're feeling okay, 78 degrees outside. I don't really trust this thing. Right now, later on today, we have a 50% chance of showers, high of 80. Still don't trust that part. But I do trust a low of 68 degrees and more showers coming Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We won't get any sun until Friday, according to this. Let's look at the traffic and... Okay, well, East Sam Houston Tollway northbound at Genoa Red Bluff. We have an accident involving one vehicle on the right shoulder. It's been cleared, but just be careful on the traffic. 288 southbound at McGregor. We have an accident involving two vehicles, one on the frontage lane that's being affected. Also, stalls-wise, we have South Sam Houston Tollway westbound before Southeast Plaza. We have a stall eating up the wet right lane. And then South Sam Houston Tollway westbound after Gessner, we have a stall on the right shoulder. And then Gulf Freeway southbound at Broadway and Park Place, somebody actually changes up and we are stalling out on the center lane. Now back to you guys in the studio.
Thank you, Don. It sounds like things are starting to load up out there on the streets. So let's go ahead and talk about something that's really important this time of year. I know it's something that as adults we face as a challenge, but in particular it's important around kids. It's cold and flu season, unfortunately. Yep, having been down here over Thanksgiving break, I know it's here in full effect. Can you guys just start by telling us a little bit about cold, maybe colds, flus, the difference between the two? Because I think a lot of times we use the language interchangeably.
Yeah, sure. So a cold is really just what doctors kind of talk about when people have symptoms of a cough, congestion, runny nose. The common cold is normally due to viruses, and there are many different viruses that can cause the common cold. Another virus that can cause something else is the influenza virus, and that causes the flu. And the flu has more severe symptoms than a normal common cold. You can have higher fevers, muscle aches, headache, and so kids are normally feeling a little bit poorer with the flu than with a common cold.
And what about the RSV virus that I've heard a lot? I know it's taken, well, I have a couple of friends that have kids that have come down and really been down for the count.
It can definitely knock you off your feet. RSV, it's a specific virus that also causes a different type of a respiratory infection that we typically call bronchiolitis. It tends to affect your lungs a little bit more than the common cold. It's an infection that tends to really affect younger kids. So that's the age group that we tend to see this particular illness in. It's
it can cause a lot of problems with breathing, and so that's the reason that we worry about it. And the kids that are most susceptible to really being affected are kids that have underlying lung disease. And so they're actually, that's one of the viruses that we do have a vaccine for in very certain high-risk populations. And so especially if you're worried that your kid falls into one of those categories, you should definitely talk to your pediatrician about that.
And what about these days? I know there are a lot of kids that have been experiencing additional kind of respiratory issues as I like clutch my chest, but because there's so much kind of still in the air and piles of debris following Harvey, have you guys seen any upswing in just general, I guess, respiratory cases or things masked?
I've definitely seen an uptick in respiratory symptoms. It's more what I guess I've seen in my clinic is more related to kids who come in with symptoms of asthma exacerbations, especially with the mold and with the debris from after Harvey. Those are definitely things that we've seen more of. And those are different, of course, from a respiratory infection. So while common colds and things like and the flu are caused by viruses, asthma is a totally different beast in terms of a respiratory illness.
Interesting.
I think one of the really important things to get across is that viruses like RSV or influenza or the flu, those are much more serious viruses. And that's one reason why I think if a parent is worried that their child could have one of those viruses, they really need to see the pediatrician because we actually have things that we can do. I mean, we support kids with RSV. We don't have any specific medicines. But the flu, gosh, that's something that we can prevent sometimes. And I'd like to hear you guys talk a little bit about why you still have time to get your flu shot. But we also have some medicines to treat the flu, unlike most viruses where we don't have medicines. And so I just think it's really important that if your child has a little bit more than the common cold, it's really time for your child to be seen by their pediatrician. Is it okay if you guys talk a little bit about the flu shot and why it's important?
Of course. Sure. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the flu vaccine for all children 6 months of age or older. And so everyone should get their flu vaccine yearly. Right now, they only recommend the inactivated flu vaccine. And so that is the shot. We no longer recommend the intranasal vaccine.
And like Dr. Bocchini was saying, the flu is certainly a lot more, can be a lot more severe of a viral illness than the common cold. I mean, even in the last flu season, over 100 children just in our country where we have resources and access to pediatricians for the most part, over 100 children died from the flu, and there are thousands more that were hospitalized that we've seen every year. And even this year, there's already been an uptick of cases, especially in Oklahoma and Louisiana, and Texas is kind of next on that list. There's already been 5 pediatric deaths from the flu this year.
Yeah, there's so many complications from the flu, whether it's bad pneumonia, it can cause a brain infection, it can cause infection of the heart. It's not a good virus, and we just really need to do everything we can to protect our patients against the flu. One of the things I always hear from patients, I don't know if you guys want to debunk this for us, but, can you get the flu from the flu shot? I hear right. that every day in clinic. I don't know. What do you guys say to your patients about that?
Yeah, so you cannot get the flu from the flu vaccine. As I said
before. Let me scratch that off my list or add it to my list of false learnings.
As I said before, the flu vaccine is an inactivated virus that is in the vaccine. And so it is very common for children to have some symptoms of some soreness at the site. They may even have some fever and just kind of an achy feeling. Those are the most common side effects that children have. But that is just your body mounting a response. It's actually a good thing for your child to have those symptoms. It's just the body prepping itself in case it sees the flu in the future, making those antibodies to keep those patients safe.
That is really embarrassing. I mean, great to know at this point in time, but, the things that we have believed for so long. The severity of some of this flu symptoms, you've talked about the deaths already this season, my mind automatically makes the jump to the reauthorization of CHIP, because I know many children rely on CHIP for things like vaccines, or if they do fall ill, if they do contract one of these viruses, to get the treatment that they need so it doesn't escalate any further than it has to. Can you guys kind of give us just kind of a state of affairs, if you will, around the reauthorization of CHIP?
Sure. So there's just under about 500,000 kids who currently rely on CHIP. And if they end up
in the state of Texas,
in Texas, and if they lose their insurance, if CHIP isn't reauthorized, then they're at risk of losing their insurance, which means they don't have access to these preventative measures. That ultimately ends up in being an increase in healthcare costs for us, because they, you know, those are the kids that are likely to catch the flu and end up being seen in the hospital with more serious complications.
Wow. And I just want to emphasize, these are families that are working families. The families make too much money to qualify for Medicaid, but their employers don't offer private insurance, and they don't make quite enough to be able to buy health insurance through the marketplace or through the exchange. So this is such a wonderful program, that a safety net program that allows these families, they pay co-pays, they pay, you know, their premiums, and I just think it's terrible that the federal government has not reauthorized CHIP. You know, it ran out in September 30th. Texas has funding until January or February. This is the time to act, and I really encourage everyone to contact their federal representative and our state senators, John Cornyn and Ted Cruz. This is really, I'm really, really surprised that we haven't reauthorized CHIP at this point.
And I think that, I know I'm very data-driven, but that number, 500,000 kids just in Texas will be impacted. That is...
It's a huge number.
Huge and terrifying. We hear the music. We know that means it's already time for our show to be wrapping up. My brain is rushing. I have like a million more questions about both CHIP and cold and flu season, but that means we get to transition to the final four. And this is where we ask the intellectually stimulating, very challenging questions. And today we will have both of our resident pediatricians answering these questions. So we will start with question number one for both of you. What was your favorite toy to play with as a child?
I still have my Barbie collection. My parents are saving it for me. So I would have to go with that.
That's awesome.
I thought about this one for a little bit. I really liked Bop It. I don't know if people remember the Bop It, but I mean, our parents probably have nightmares still about the Bop It.
All the noise.
I loved that game.
Yes, absolutely. And what about when you guys were growing up? What did you want to be?
I always thought I was going to be a ballerina. I never thought that I would do anything medical. I thought I would grow up and dance on Broadway.
Very nice.
I was somewhere between a detective, astronaut, or doctor, and I, you know, at least I picked one of them.
That could be a tough decision.
I know.
What about your favorite book to read as you were a kid?
The detective was hugely a part because I loved Nancy Drew.
Nancy Drew,
so
yes.
she was my girl.
That's awesome. I remember one of the other residents mentioning that as well.
I liked Little Red Riding Hood. I definitely memorized it way before I could read and would definitely let you know if you went out of order.
Those pre-literacy skills count as reading. And last question real quick as we're running out of time here. When you were a kid and came down with the cold or flu, what was the best home remedy that could always make you feel better?
Oh, I feel like my mother used to put rice in a sock, and she would put it like on your forehead or on your ear, and I just always remember that was something that made me feel super.
Rice in a sock.
Yeah.
Got it. I'll try that.
Yeah, it's super better.
Ed, what
just
about
the
now?
Classics. Soup and hot tea.
Absolutely. I agree. That's what it was like in my house. Well, thank you guys for participating this afternoon. And thank you to all of you for listening. For more facts and information on children, visit us at childrenatrisk.org. Follow us on Twitter and listen in every Monday morning for commentary of activism and children during the KPFT Morning News at 8. We love to hear from you, so like us on Facebook and send us your thoughts at radio@childrenatrisk.org. Thank you to our engineer, Don. Hug your kids and see you next time on Growing Up in America on Pacifica Radio.
We want to thank you, the listeners, and those who contributed to our successful fall fund drive. This is Interim General Manager Larry Winters asking you to please consider a year-end tax-deductible donation to your favorite Pacifica Foundation station, KPFT. This can be done in several different ways. You can call our business department at extension 314 at 713-526-4000 during business hours, or go to kpft.org, or go to kpftfacebook.com/kpfthouston. Then click on the donate button, and don't forget, you're listening to KPFT 90.1 in Houston.
We're like Bonnie and Clyde, Johnny and June, nothing to gain, nothing to lose. 1 foot in the grave, 1 foot up on the gas. There's mountains to climb, giants to slay, lessons to learn, prayers to pray, and there ain't no time for living in the past.
The historic Heights Theater on 19th Street has been reborn as a community art house, now hosting a wide variety of concerts and special events. Upcoming shows include a Tex-Mex Holiday Fiesta with Los Tex-Maniacs, featuring Flaco Jimenez, Peter Rowan, and Rick Trevino December 20th. Guy Forsythe and Carolyn Wonderland roasting